Welcome to the Money Maze Podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. In 1991, employees of Morgan Stanley were informed of a visionary management decision to relocate from the West End to a partially constructed Canary Wharf. We were told that we were the pioneers, one of two international banks moving there, and the irony in today's conversation being that the other pioneer bank moving to Cabot Square, Canary Wharf, was none other than Credit Suisse. No tube extension had been built. There was only one Docklands Light Railway. Buses, or for those of us who drove, we descended into the concrete bowels of this soulless complex and were missing the West End acutely. Although I arrived by 7 o'clock every day, there was always one car parked well ahead of me. Its engine no longer warm, because its owner and our guest today would already have been at his desk for some time. Such work ethic is just one of the reasons he became CFO and president of Morgan Stanley, and today is chairman of UBS. One of the most influential and capable of banking executives of the last several decades, dubbed by the FT as Europe's most powerful banker. And a former colleague, Rob Rooney, who became CEO of Morgan Stanley International, said, "No one else I met matched him for the relationships he cultivated, his understanding of markets and risk, developing strategy and assessing, unlike most others, how to work through the noise and nonsense. He's truly one of the great athletes of financial services." Colin Keller, welcome to the Money Maze Podcast.
Welcome. Well, what do I say to that? Right.
Well, we're here in Zurich. It's taken 18 months to pin you down, but we'll excuse you because we've been very busy helping UBS grow its market capitalization to nearly $100 billion, and we'll be discussing growth and integration as we go along. But I, first of all, as a disclaimer, I'm a shareholder, have been for several years. I'm also a client of the old Credit Suisse, now UBS in London, the Direct Access Group, and I have to say I've worked with a few banks. Very good indeed, very happy. But Colm, I'd like to reflect back just for a little bit onto your upbringing. You're one of nine children born in the Irish village of Bandoon and brought up in Warrington. Which order of children were you?
Well, I'm actually not just one of nine. I'm one of eight boys and one girl. And I'm number four, number three son, right?
And I got the impression you had to fight for attention. And I just wondered if that's where you acquired your true grit.
Well, I don't think I ever fought for attention. I had very loving parents, but they had very many children. My father was a doctor and was working ridiculous hours, so we didn't see much of him. And you just get on and do your own thing. So rather than fighting for attention, I think I learned to entertain myself, as it were. And I was very fortunate because in those days, England was much more segregated than it is now. You lived in an Irish community. Right. Now it's cool to be Irish. In the early 60s, being Irish was not a cool thing, as you may remember. So we were in this strong Irish community. And even though we'd moved from Ireland, we still did our Gaelic lessons. We did our Irish dancing lessons, the music, the whole thing that goes with Irish culture. And of course, I went to an Irish school in Liverpool. So really, my only real experience of English people was when I went to university in England. It's the first time I left that sort of community.
And what would you say was the most important lesson your parents taught you?
My parents were great educationalists. They came from professional middle-class families. Both my parents were graduates. My grandparents had been graduates. So the expectation from my father was that public duty was what mattered. He was a doctor. He came from a family of doctors and civil servants. My mother's father was one of the movers in the foundation of the Republic and became chief of police in Ireland. So they believed in public service more than anything and giving back.
So when we think about education, you get your MA in history from Oxford. And I also note that today you are the visiting professor of banking and finance at the Loughborough Business School. And we now at the Money Based Podcast sponsor 10 university finance societies. And so we're very, very keen, and some of the questions we might come back to will be about, you know, trying to help guide youth as they think about their careers. But you start as an accountant, Arthur Anderson, and then switch to Morgan Stanley. We actually started it, I think, 1989, you know, the same year. Now, there were lots of bright, motivated, hardworking employees at Morgan Stanley. When you look back, how do you explain your progress?
Well, there's a slight gap there, which is important. I went from Arthur Anderson to County Bank, which was the subsidiary of NatWest. And in the early 80s, as you remember, the British were still credible in investment banking. And then the Americans came in the late 80s and swept everything ahead of them. There had been Black Monday in the UK, and County Bank was caught up in the underwriting of a big deal that went wrong. And what British banks did then is they just stopped and started. They fired everybody and started again. So I realized at County that the Brits fundamentally did not understand the risks of investment banking. So I wanted to join an American investment bank. And I was fortunate in Bob Diamond recruited me to Morgan Stanley, where I began at the bottom. Because in those days, that's what you did in American investment banks. And the realization was that they knew risk. They would ride through cycles and so on. So when I joined, there were a lot of people there who had a sense of entitlement because they'd gone through business schools, whatever, and so on. But I, having had worked at County Bank, could not believe how easy it was to get a client to answer your phone call from Morgan Stanley. The brand was so important. And therefore, I think that was the edge. Having worked somewhere before and suddenly realizing, wow, clients take this firm seriously. That's why I got in earlier than other people and built up a client base and so on and did it that way.
Well, if we advance forward to the financial crisis, I'd already left, but you are occupying one of the most important seats as chief financial officer. And we watched the cards fall from Bear Stearns being acquired by JP, Lehman, AIG, the list goes on. And Morgan Stanley, of course, was next on the list. And those were, as has been recorded, some of the darkest days for you and for others. And I wonder what stays with you the most as you reflect on that period.
Well, it was a very stressful period, and I'd never really undergone stress before, and I never knew what stress was till then. That still stays with me. Just as an aside, for at least 3 years after those events, I couldn't talk about them. You just get on with things and so on. But what was very important was a number of things. The culture of Morgan Stanley was incredibly strong. So my one memory of those five crucial weeks in September, October 08, where you're quite right, Morgan Stanley almost disappeared, was the number of senior people who would just sit out on the 40th floor and help in any way they could, rather than panicking and being self-interested and so on. So it was that sense of wanting to work together. Also being aware that everybody was watching us. So John Mack would say to me when I go up in the lifts, by the way, I put on 35 pounds in weight in 6 months. So that's how I react to stress. And John would say, Colm, smile, they're watching us. So we do that. And everybody was panicking because they knew just how close we were getting to it. But it was that sense of teamwork and keeping it together and never giving in, which I think differentiated Morgan Stanley from other firms. And of course, as you do know, we, because of the commitment of people, everybody, people you've mentioned before, and also finally the Japanese, we managed to get through that.
So it reminded me of W.B. Yeats's great poem about things fall apart. The center cannot hold me. Yeah. Anarchy is loosed upon the world. You negotiate with UFJ. I think it's a $9 billion injection. Sure. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would like to hear this, that the banks were closed for a bank holiday and that you received the largest certified check ever.
Well, that was Rob Kindler, who was head of M&A, as you know, and it was Columbus Day. And what had happened that weekend was that we were trading, our stock got to an intraday low of $6.71, which you may remember. And our CDS were basically trading at a level that's saying that we were bankrupt, thousands of basis points. And another story, the rating agencies, I'm not saying which one, were going to downgrade us to sub-investment grade. And I rang them and said, we're closing the deal. They said, we don't believe you. Well, we got a very senior US government person to ring them to say the deal was closing. They still didn't believe us, right? So you can imagine the panic going into the weekend. So we were afraid it was Columbus Day. that we would open and not have the check cleared, and not have the cash cleared. And Kindler came up with the idea of a physical check. And Rob got the physical check. Now, Rob turned up at the Japanese bank, MUFG, to get the check. You know Kindler, he's rather casual. He's in his Lacoste shirt and his shorts because it's Columbus Day. But there's this huge delegation of Japanese banks ready to present him. So he had to borrow one of his lawyer's jackets, which he split because he's quite overweight. And then he got this photograph of the check. Now, since then, there have been at least 8 original copies of that check in Morgan Stanley people's offices. So anyway, that's what happened, and that's how we got through it.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. We just interviewed General Sir Patrick Sarnes, who's just retired as the head of the British Army, and he talked about stress and resilience. And for people listening who, in much smaller ways, are having to face those real tests, is there one lesson that stayed with you?
Well, the one lesson that I've always had is that you can only worry about what you can't control. So too many people worry about things that are outside their control. I mean, what GDP will do, whatever, right? But you've got to focus on those things where you can actually make a difference. By the way, I remember one of the great lines from the crisis was when Gary Cohn said to Lloyd Blankfein, "Oh, this is terrible. I mean, this is the end of the world." And Lloyd said, "This is not landing a Bailey boat on Utah Beach." And let's put it in perspective, the stress and the stress. At the end of the day, the stress for us was the ongoing continuation of Morgan Stanley and what that meant for people. It wasn't life and death.
And so you stayed at Morgan Stanley for a long time, through to whatever it is, 2019, and you work with Gorman, who was on one of our former guests, Nikolai Tangen's, you know, show, and you work very well together. And as we think about leadership, and as I mentioned, we've got Tony Blair coming on, and he's going to talk about his new book on leadership. What was it that you reflected in Gorman in his leadership style that you admired enough to stay so long?
Yeah, James and I had got to know each other quite well because we'd been co-heads of firm strategy when I was CFO and he was head of wealth management. So we'd actually developed a relationship. James, as you know, initially was quite stiff, quite distant, and he really opened up a lot as CEO. What James always had was a very cool strategic mind. He looked at things very clinically and without emotion in many ways. And I really respected that about him. What I also knew was that given the crisis that we'd been through with John, and John has his fans and his detractors, but John at the end of the day did get Morgan Stanley through 2008. And I'd like to talk about that in a bit if I can, because there's a chapter on that that isn't that known that well. But when James became CEO in early 2010, we needed a change in direction. And because he came from the wealth management world, and that was the value add, that was the value proposition for Morgan Stanley, it was absolutely right that he did that. Now, as you know, there were some of the old guard at Morgan Stanley who did not believe in wealth management. They still believed in this white shoe investment banking firm, and the world had moved on. But James did that, and I was able, running the investment bank, to work very closely with him because I understood that value proposition. And we ended up becoming very close friends, in fact, and having a very effective partnership. And I must admit, when I retired, James went, if anything, over the top in the things he said about me. So it was very good. Yep.
Can we just reflect back on that John Mack comment?
Yeah, what people don't realize, so when I defend John, people say, why do you defend John? You say he put out the fire, but he started the fire, right? Which is the old 2008 argument, Chuck Prince, mm-hmm. You know, you got to dance until the music stops. Remember the line. But John did one thing that I don't believe any other individual would ever have done. There was a period in that 5 week when Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Tim Geithner, president of the New York Fed, and Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary, instructed John to sell the firm to Jamie at Chase. And John flatly refused to do it. He said, I will not do that. It's not in the interest of my shareholders. You know, you will have to replace me and my board. Right. Now, of course, they ran out of time and couldn't do it. I don't think many people would have had the courage to do that in the way John did, because John was absolutely convinced we closed the deal with the Japanese. But they were clearly very worried of the whole contagion and whatever it was. So John should get total credit for holding the line on that, which was, frankly, a pretty brave thing to do.
And true that you were coming back from a meeting with Gartner and Paulson and somebody slammed into your car and you then had to conduct proceedings lying flat on your back in pain for the next few days.
Well, that was pretty unpleasant. That was almost midnight and it was a New York Public Utilities, a sanitation truck that hit us in the back.
So you retire, but of course, to misquote Dylan Thomas, you do not go gently into that night because UBS come calling. And I wondered what it was that ultimately was the magnetic force.
Well, I retired and I had a view that I wanted to write a novel. I had a number of things I wanted to do, and I did some of those things. And I thought I'd teach. And I was offered a teaching post at a second-tier university. That's a joke. The number two university, right? But anyway, I realized very quickly that academic life is very tricky, particularly in this woke age, and particularly when you've been a banker. So I just didn't think that that was going to work out. I wasn't cut out for it. And as you're probably aware, I was approached by a private equity firm to step in and be chairman of a troubled European institution, not Credit Suisse. And that did interest me, but that fell apart for a number of reasons. So I think that put me on the radar map that I was prepared to come back in and do something. And that's when UBS approached me. In addition to that, my wife, frankly, just didn't want to have me at home anymore.
And today, over a year on from the, you know, from the integration, we'll come a little bit back to that when we talk about culture. How would you assess where you are?
The easy bit of the integration, if there is an easy bit, has been done and ahead of schedule. All the legal entity mergers, by and large, have happened. And by the way, we've had fantastic support from global regulators on that, because I think they really did view us very favorably for stepping in and acquiring Credit Suisse. The initial costs, the easy costs are done, but now we have a big slog. We've got a 2.5 year period. In any integration, particularly of a bank, is the whole data and technology issue, which is the biggest issue. We have over 110 million gigabytes of data that we have to clean up from Credit Suisse and bring onto our database, customer migration and so on. That will take some time. It's only when you've done that stuff can you then get out those back-end costs, because, you know, so many of those costs are allocated on a basis. So that's where we are. I'm absolutely confident we will do it. I was very fortunate to get Sergio back. And the board was very fortunate to get Sergio back, because we got a person who knew the bank well, who hit the ground running, who was Swiss. And as you're aware, probably predicting some of your questions, there is a bifurcation between the global view of what happened in Switzerland and the Swiss view. So having Sergio, who's Swiss here, was absolutely critical.
And as we talk about that Morgan Stanley experience, you find yourself confronted with a not identical, but a moment of acute stress, spotlight, short timelines. Do you think when you reflect back that the key to making it as successful as it has been was in the negotiations or in the preparation?
No, it was all in the preparation. I mean, when I took the job at UBS, I was absolutely convinced. Well, first of all, I could see that Credit Suisse was in trouble. Credit Suisse was not going to succeed as a standalone or institution. Something was going to happen. And being UBS, we would be involved. Now, my suspicion was that we would be involved as a validator rather than an acquirer. You know, they'd have to make sure that we were in the mix to make sure and so on. But of course, as you know, and so I did prepare, and that was my Morgan Stanley experience. And it won't surprise you to know that my external advisors were Morgan Stanley. So unofficially, I was talking to them anyway. Then October 22 happened, which I think was a real meltdown in Credit Suisse. It was their strategic plan. It was the run of the bank and everything. And that's when I officially appointed external advisors. And even then, even at that point, the government and regulators had not been in touch with us. So we were getting ready. Because I knew when the weekend happened, and it would be a weekend, I had to have a list of demands pre-cooked. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. Now, remember that UBS had a very viable standalone strategy, and our stock was doing well at that point, had done very well already. So the idea that we were going to have to take on this minimum 3-year break in what we were doing to merge and fix it and so on, and also probably have a real dent to our valuation on price to book, which did happen initially, and we're still trading at a bit of a discount on that. So then I got the phone call, and funny enough, I was talking to my advisors at Morgan Stanley when the call came through, and I said, I think this is the call, and I went and took the call. But a very odd thing happened. It was, for a couple of minutes, quite emotional for me, because it was a rerun of 2008. The difference is, though, that this time we were not the victim. We were bailing somebody out. So that, but it's still, you still, and I had terrible thoughts about those poor Credit Suisse employees and stakeholders, like I thought about our Morgan Stanley employees who suddenly saw everything wiped out. But anyway, we went over and we saw the minister was there, the president of Swiss National Bank, the chairman of FINMA and the CEO of FINMA. And we said, yeah, we're prepared to do it, but on these terms. And I have a fiduciary interest. I can't just do it because the Swiss government are telling me that it has to be done. This has to make sense. And I was very, very worried that the Monday open, we would be caught in a contamination spiral like Credit Suisse. We've gone in, but we'd be sucked down with them. And that was one of the reasons why I insisted initially, which you may remember, on second loss guarantees from the Swiss government, which they'd never done. Now, of course, we gave those back as soon as we realized we didn't need them, but we had to have them. And on the Monday morning, our stock did initially trade down 17% before people you know came in to start buying the stock.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is now sponsored by the World Gold Council. Gold has been at the foundation of human civilizations and economic history, from the pharaohs of ancient Egypt to James Bond, through to its vital role in central bank reserves. Gold has come to symbolize trade, culture, and currency. Discover the transformational powers of gold by watching Idris Elba's film on an adventure that explores gold's meaning and contribution to societies and economies the world over. Visit journey.gold on your browser to learn more. Two things that strike me is, one is the UBS brand and how you think about it and how you would like it to be assessed externally.
Well, the UBS brand, like Morgan Stanley's brand, got tarnished for a while. But you will remember the dream ticket was always the Morgan Stanley-UBS merger. UBS was seen as a European equivalent of Morgan Stanley, both global wealth managers, both very respected. UBS originally had Warburg, Morgan Stanley, the bank. So the brand is very, very strong. I mean, historically in Switzerland, though, it was different because in Switzerland, UBS was viewed as the sleepy bank and Credit Suisse was the entrepreneurial bank. And we do have this mismatch, again, as I said, between international and Swiss perceptions of what happened. But what UBS has got, and one of the things I judge a culture from, which is also reflected in a brand, is I always ask people, how long have you been at this firm? Remember, at Morgan Stanley, we'd always ask people, how long have you been at the firm? You know, they were there 5 years, like, so what? You're right. Yes. But at UBS, a lot of continuity, a lot of average tenor of service. So that is actually a very good reflection. And I think UBS is seen as a wealth manager of excellence, a wealth manager for high net worth, ultra high net worth. It's a brand that needs to be polished and cherished. So I do think it's that perception that we are primarily the preeminent global wealth manager in the world.
So I'm going to come back to culture in a minute, but let's just stay with banking more generally. Yeah. Looking ahead the next few years, what might surprise us most generally with the world of banking?
I think what's going to happen in banking is going to happen anyway. I mean, you're going to see a continual polarization between the very big and the excellent and the small. And the small are going to be threatened by fintech and by changes in banking itself, AI and so on. You'll see that particularly in the US, where the regional banks will either have to adapt or be taken over, right? We've already seen a position in the world where if since 2008, what's called the non-bank financial intermediary sector, shadow banking, has grown from 38% of the pie to 50% of the pie. That means that $230 trillion of assets are now outside the regulated banking sector. That is the challenge for banking. So banking needs to make itself continue to be relevant to its customers and so on. But equally, regulators need to understand that if they want to understand risk, they can't just regulate banks. Now, I'm not asking them to regulate everybody else, but I'm asking them to be very careful about how they regulate the banks so you don't force more and more assets out of the banking sector and more clients. That is the big challenge for banking.
Yes, and we've had a lot of conversations in the Money's podcast with a lot of people in that private market space, and old-timers like myself kind of, you know, sometimes go, it's just extraordinary. And it does appear to pose risks for which the regulators are unprepared. Is that too naive an observation?
I think they are unprepared. In 2009, I remember speaking to Governor Dan Tarullo saying that, I understand why you're forcing assets out of the banking sector. You want to make the banking sector smaller and more capable of being regulated. But at some point, you're not going to be able to know what these risks will be going forward. He totally disagreed with that point. Nowadays, if you talk to the FSB or G30 or any of the other bodies, they get that this is an issue. And I think they're now beginning to look at how they can assess those risks. I think there are some weird ways of assessing the risk. One regulator is doing is looking at the bank's exposure to shadow banking, but the banks are regulated. The more you regulate that, the more that stuff will even leave the banking sector again and go somewhere else. So I do think they have to get this sorted out. I get the sense that people like Clive Knott understand this issue, and Jay Powell certainly understands this issue. So I do think we'll see something happening there. Now, I am not, to my private equity client friends and whatever, I am not asking that you be regulated, right? What I'm asking is that we have disclosure of what the risks are.
I'd like to talk a little bit about geography, both opportunities and challenges. We've had this juxtaposition of the US and all that it has done when it's been manifested well at a firm like Morgan Stanley. And we have Europe that labors under all sorts of challenges, whether it's at a macro level or at an individual country, questions sure. around self-determination. Hugh Van Steenis, who we both know, I was chatting to him, and he said, can European financials compete on a global stage? And if so, how?
Well, the answer is yes, eventually. But there is a fundamental problem in Europe. I've said it many times. And 80% of lending in Europe is via the banking system. Completely the inverse of the US, where 20% is via bank loans, the rest is via markets, securitization, whatever. So Europe has got a fundamentally wrong way risk banking system, i.e. if there's a recession, what the banks start doing, they stop lending, right? Exactly when they need to be lending. Now, the good news is there have been two big initiatives which are giving me real hope in Europe. And I think we will see things happening over this five-year term of this European Parliament, which will slowly start the changes, which means that Europe will be able to compete. The first is the letter report, which you've read. And I think the one damning statistic out of that report is that Europe leaks 300 billion euros a year into US capital markets because there's nowhere to invest in Europe. This is the whole equification and so on. And we're awaiting the Draghi report on competitiveness, which is already pointing out how many exchanges there are, the lack of cross-border banking consolidation. Europe can't really, the banking system can't keep getting big within the nation boundaries. I mean, look at the UBS Credit Suisse, already the noise that's made. But you've got to allow cross-border rationalization of banking. I think that will come. For that to happen, you're going to need common bankruptcy laws. You're going to need a securitization framework. You'll need a number of things. But I am actually quite optimistic that the European Commission understands this and we will see movement. It will be slow movement, but it will be movement. The share of banking in Europe that the Americans have taken is 12%. Since 2007. This is clearly not sustainable.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a leading provider of active asset management, advisory and wealth management services, recognized as a leader in sustainability. Few investment managers can match the combination of capabilities and global reach that Schroders offer. Across public and private markets, Schroders offers distinctive investment solutions for the diverse needs of wealth, pension and insurance clients and the other owners of long-term assets, providing excellent long-term investment outcomes when Schroders succeeds for clients, society and the wider world benefit too. So we had your friend, Manny Roman, on earlier in the year as well. I won't say he was despairing of the sort of the euro issues, but clearly was reflecting on them. And we also have this even more significant dynamic of the UK's more recent isolation and Switzerland's rather unique position as well. Do we think that the thaw is setting in and that we can look to more cooperation?
Well, when Manny's negative, it's surprising because Manny is a true European and maybe, and I'm normally quite negative, but I think I see positive strands there. This is not going to happen overnight. One of the great tragedies of the UK leaving Europe, I do think it was a mistake. Sorry, I know you're not meant to say that, but it was a mistake, is that Europe lost a really credible voice within the issue of market structure and market capability. And Britain had very good allies within the EU who were supportive of them. There isn't that voice now, right? And Britain is a third country. If you were to speak to the European Union and you speak to anybody you want to there, yeah, we like the UK, but it's a third country. We're not doing special deals with third countries. And this idea that somehow Britain can create a special deal ain't going to happen. The same is true for Switzerland. I mean, Switzerland feels it's closer to the EU. Switzerland will never, in my opinion, join the EU, right? But it was close to the EU. It thinks it should get better treatment. But again, Switzerland is a third country. So I think we just got to have to make sure that we have workable MRAs between the EU and the UK, the EU and Switzerland, that will make things work.
And when we think about UBS as a non-US institution trying to grow its footprint in the US, always been difficult for the Europeans. How do you reflect on that now?
Well, I think, first of all, we are a US institution as well. So we uniquely are a European bank that own a major wirehouse. I mean, Payne Webber is part of UBS. So I think we have our foot in the States and we're not trying to build up through retail banking like others. We have 1.8 trillion assets. We have the Payne Webber network. We've never done a particularly good job of integrating that. By the way, this is history repeating itself. This is Dean Witter and Morgan Stanley. It's the same issue. So first of all, what we have to do, we've changed leadership now, and I'm very positive about the leadership changes we've made. We need to integrate Payne Webber properly into UBS. We need to get our national bank charter. We need to have the full range of banking products for our clients, which you know very well. So you own the client from both the asset and the liability side. Then you can start giving the tax advice and estate planning and everything else that makes that book of business sticky and makes the PBT margin more predictable. So I think we will do that. Of course, what you'll then say to me is, but can UBS in the long run really compete with Morgan Stanley or Bank of America because they're such big scale players? We have 6,000 FAs in the States and, as I said, 1.8 trillion of assets. So clearly we have critical mass, but at some point in the future, not the short-term future, we have to look at that scale issue. But first of all, let's deal with making sure that the PBT margin itself is much more predictable.
And we have a habit in the West of Peter Frankopan's expression, he's been on the show, is, you know, we have our eyes stitched closed. You know, when we think about the rest of the world, you've got a huge business in Asia with all of the attendant opportunities. Just give us again a sense of how big, exciting, and, you know, what the potential is there.
I mean, UBS, it used to annoy me at Morgan Stanley how big UBS were in investment banking in Asia, where they are number one. And clearly in wealth management, we're the biggest by far. We are very well positioned. UBS is very well respected. It was very early into China. China is a fact of life, right? Very big in South Asia, PAC, and so on, and big in Australia. So we have a very big practice. We're also very well liked. We are the only bank represented on the Hong Kong CEO's Advisory Council, the only Western bank. So we're very well positioned within China, Greater China, and so on. I think we're very well respected in that part of the world, and we made significant strategic choices there. So for us, the whole Asia-Pacific area is a big growth area for us. We're already big and we will continue to grow. In the meantime, though, you can't ignore the US because the US is the single largest capital market in the world and it's where evolution is happening more quickly than anywhere else. And as I said, we're lucky enough to have a property in the US anyway.
So back to culture, because that ultimately is so often the driver of the difference between the great and the not so great businesses. How do you go about reinforcing good values and building good culture?
It's a very interesting issue. Governor Tarullo, after the GFC in 08, decided that what distinguished good banks from bad banks, those who'd somehow got through, was culture. So he looked at how do you regulate for culture? And of course, he found out it's impossible to regulate for culture. Culture is what it is. I mean, the Germans have that great expression, the fish stinks from the head, right? So I think a lot of it is about leadership. But a lot of it is also about making sure that you have people who believe they're part of the firm, they're there a long time, you applaud and laud people who have lengthy service, you have the ability to move people around. But what we do is we have a CCRC, a culture committee at board level, which is chaired by me, that regularly reports to the board. We do all sorts of mini surveys, employee feedback. We do all the measurements of whistleblowing, everything else to make sure that we're aware of where we are. But at the end of the day, I do believe culture comes down to management and the respect for that management, right? So if you start compromising on who your leadership is for short-term gains or so on, you get exactly what happens at Credit Suisse.
And the only thing that would worry, might worry some, about the size of all such institutions as UBS is that the entrepreneurialism that was really important at the beginning is, if not extinguished, it is, you know, it's curtailed.
Well, there are different types of entrepreneurship, but I think the role of a bank is to service entrepreneurs rather than be an entrepreneur itself, personally. If you want to be an entrepreneur, set up your own fund, have a private equity fund, have a venture capital fund. One of the things I heard at Credit Suisse when I was doing my diagnostics there is that people took great pride in how entrepreneurial Credit Suisse was. And I'm thinking that's not really our job. Our job is to make sure that we service entrepreneurs. Yes, do we have an entrepreneurial spirit to make sure that we develop new products to satisfy clients? So yes, but I think the role of a bank is primarily to service its clients.
Okay, that's very clearly expressed. Let's talk about the leadership. You've referred to Sergio Motta's importance. You're the chair, he's the CEO. You know, lots of different models of relationships between CEO and chairs. How have you figured out how to make that work, given that, you know, you've had very clear views about how businesses should be run?
Well, first of all, we tend to agree. Secondly, the role of the chairman in Swiss banking is very clear, right? It's not the same as the role of a chairman in a UK bank, right? Chairman in a Swiss bank has responsibility for strategy, right, with the board. So that makes life easy when you have that delineation. I got to know Sergio well before the acquisition. And, you know, he's a very similar background to me. He came up through the equity side. I came up through the fixed income side, so I can probably add better than him. But we both came up through markets and understand that, and we both like clients. But Sergio, like me, is an individual who suits the moment and we're probably right for now. What you need to make sure is that you have a bench of the right people so that they continue to service the institution and the execution of the strategy itself. But Sergio and I get on, you know, we understand each other. We do have disagreements. It would be odd if we didn't. But they're the sort of disagreements that you and I would have had when we were working together and we resolve them and so on. So the main thing is when we brought Sergio back, we gave him three conditions, which were very important for us, for him to resume the role. One is that he would give us 5 years. Two is that he would deliver a bench of potential successors before he left, so it was credible. And three is that we'd fix the US. And those three things, we still fundamentally agree on those three things.
So I'm going to move to some general questions. You've had 40 years of deal making. What would you say is the mistake that stays with you, and what did you take from it?
When people ask you, everybody makes mistakes, right? There's a great line in The Charterhouse of Parma by Stendhal where the general is asked, if you knew today what you did yesterday when you made that mistake, would you have done it? He said, what an insult to my intelligence to think that I would have known any better when I made the mistake. So that's kind of where I am. I have made mistakes, but you learn from them and move on. I don't think I made any mistakes that sort of keep me awake at night. I think it comes back to my general belief that you can only worry about what you can control. And if that's the case, you get on with it. So look, investment banking is it's a capricious world. Many intelligent people joining, much smarter than me, join investment banking and don't quite get to the levels they want to get to. And somehow you get to those levels. Sometimes it's because you avoided mistakes. Sometimes it's because people adopted you. Sometimes you were just lucky in getting the right call at the right time. And that's the way I'd look at it. At the end of the day, you've got to have a fundamental belief of what is your job. And my fundamental belief is that I don't think I was ever cut out to be a sole practitioner, an entrepreneur. I always felt that I was better off working in an institution with an institutional framework and an institutional hierarchy that I could understand and navigate.
Well, I, for one, would attest to the luck being so vital in my own journey.
Yeah.
Stress comes in many different forms. You've commented on, you know, how stressful it was during that period. What advice would you offer to anybody in terms of how you deal with stress?
I think I said it before, it's knocking out the background stuff that's irrelevant. It's focusing on what you can control. It's having a great partner. In my case, I had a fantastic, and still have a fantastic wife, who stood by me and was there for me.
Do you think that CEOs of businesses, not just banking business, but generally share notes and compare notes enough?
Probably not. I think Gorman was very good at doing that. But generally, no. I think there's that famous Harvard Business School paper on the CEO as narcissist. And I think most CEOs probably fall into that category. I found some CEOs have been incredibly helpful. Jamie Dimon has been incredibly helpful, as an example. There are others as well. So there are exceptions. And over the years, I've known clients, CEOs who've been very helpful and so on. But as a general point, I think CEOs are a special breed.
So I'm going to ask you two closing questions. I know you're not just a history lover, but I actually read that at some point in time, you might have wanted to become a specialist in Byzantine history. And back to Peter Frankopan, who is now occupying that chair at Oxford. If you could meet one figure from history, who would it be and why?
It probably would be Justinian, because he ruled for so long. And if you look at the span of his empire, he rebuilt a lot of the Western Roman Empire. He also, and a lot of people don't know this, probably had the worst plague in the history of the world, which killed 40% of the population and survived that. And he had an amazing wife. And there's, by the way, a new book out, a new biography of Justinian, which completely revisits the idea of Theodora as empress and what value she brought. And she clearly was an extraordinary lady. So I think Justinian would be a cool guy to meet.
And of course, it couldn't be a complete interview if we didn't talk about golf. You are a very keen golfer. If you could choose any course in the world, it's a four ball. Where are you going to play and who are the three who are going to join you?
Well, obviously you would be one, right?
Let's just say I'm injured.
Right. Maybe it would be Old Head in Kinsale. It's, where I lived as a child. It's a magnificent area. It's Irish. Of course, I'd pick it. And who would I, you want me to play with famous people?
Just the three people that you would like to play.
Well, frankly, this sounds corny. I'd like to play with my wife and two sons.
Colin, we're going to stop there. I've been really looking forward to seeing you again, to having this conversation. I do think that people who are outsiders won't have understood quite the significance as you looked over the chasm in 08 and Morgan Stanley was teetering. I mean, it was extraordinary. It did remind me when the father's advice to his son from Kipling, which is if you could keep your head when all about are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, you definitely survived that test.
One last comment on that, and you know these people. I had an incredible team in 08 around me. I had Ted Pick. I had Mo Asimov, Serkan Savasoglu, you know, Rob Kindler. Paul Worth. I'm not doing justice to all the people who were there. That team worked day and night to keep things afloat. And I am absolutely delighted that Ted is now the CEO of Morgan Stanley. I think Morgan Stanley will do very well under Pick.
Well, Colin, you've shared lots of great thoughts about leadership and culture, about the journey that UBS is on. And I just like to wish you good luck and thank you again very much.
Thanks a lot for this. Thank you.